Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, the necessity of nonviolent popular rebellions. A few thoughts from me, plus a lot of help from singer David Rovix and historian Howard Zinn. I hope you'll stay tuned. My heart leaps up when I behold the American people getting uppity again, getting off of their fatty acids, rising from their sofas, and taking to the streets. American history has shown time and again that the only time the system will allow itself to be reformed is in the face of large-scale, public, nonviolent rebellion. Let's be clear. We are celebrating nonviolent popular resistance to oppression. Nobody involved in this broadcast, including your humble reporter, is advocating violent resistance, not even violence against property. For one, the rebels don't have a prayer of winning a violent conflict against the armed might of the system. For another, as Chris Hedges has noted over and over again, in a war or violent rebellion, the worst psychopaths usually rise to power on both sides of the conflict, and the decent people on both sides end up being destroyed. And the third reason to keep the resistance nonviolent is this. Violent popular resistance has a lousy track record of yielding lasting change for the better. And nonviolent resistance has a pretty good track record. Think of India's independence movement, South Africa's overthrow of the white apartheid government, the final overthrow of Soviet-style communism in Eastern Europe, the U.S. movements for female suffrage and gender equality, the labor struggles all through the 20th century, the ending by the citizens of the Vietnam War, the modern gay rights movement. All of these predominantly nonviolent popular movements brought about substantial change in the status quo. You can probably think of several other examples, too. Back when he was New York Times international correspondent, Chris Hedges witnessed some of these popular rebellions abroad at first hand. And he notes that in each case, almost nobody could see it coming beforehand. Here's a recent example. This is me speaking, not Hedges. Tunisians had been oppressed by dictator Ben Ali for decades. In December 2010, an obscure street vendor in a provincial town, Mohamed Bouazizi was his name, he was harassed by the police, and he protested his own grievances by setting himself on fire. For some reason, that set off massive popular demonstrations throughout Tunisia. Soon afterwards, Ben Ali resigned and fled. Then Tunisia touched off the entire Arab Spring, so-called. Notably, the Egyptians followed suit, flooding Cairo's Tahrir Square with people at the beginning of 2011. They were protesting the denial of their civil rights and also the police brutality that they too had suffered for decades. The many Egyptian protests led to the resignation of Egypt's dictator Mubarak in February 2011. Why all this in 2011 rather than 2009 or 2013? Nobody knows, and nobody saw it coming. Then in September 2011 began our own large-scale, nonviolent citizens' rebellion. Occupy Wall Street and simultaneous Occupy encampments in other cities as well. Even Hartford. Now, again unpredictably, we are seeing very widespread, nonviolent citizens' demonstrations protesting the police brutality against black people, the brutality that many Americans had ignored for decades. This popular rebellion against police racial oppression is surprisingly widespread. Here in Connecticut, in small, mainly white, economically comfortable towns, the citizens are joining Black Lives Matter marches and demonstrations. Many white citizens, whom the police have always treated courteously, are taking to the streets in predominantly white country towns like Ellington, just up the road a spell from my own digs. There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear, but it looks very encouraging. To be sure, there is often some small-scale looting and arson on the fringes of massive nonviolent protests. And naturally, U.S. President Voldemort is focusing on and greatly exaggerating all the fringe crime. In the view he advances, Black Lives Matter is a radical communist anarchist group intent on destroying democracy and everything else good in America. And they are aided and abetted by radical communist anarchist revolutionaries such as the left-wing menace to society, Joe Biden. Somehow, President Voldemort is blaming the out-of-power Democrats for all the disruption that is occurring during Voldemort's own administration. Personally, I think the president is starting to give the narcissistic personality disorder community a bad name. In any case, here in Connecticut, the people, unpredictably and suddenly, the people have had it with police racism and violence. Nonetheless, life here is pretty much normal, apart from the pandemic, of course. On the other hand, the citizens' rebellion in Portland, Oregon has been much more active, with huge public demonstrations pretty much taking over a good portion of downtown for many weeks. Apparently, the Portland mass uprising started in May 2020. It was touched off by the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as were thousands of other protests nationwide. The Portland rebellion began with a peaceful march led by the NAACP. Then it kept growing and mutating and growing and mutating. From my vantage point, 3,000 miles away, I confess to having only the foggiest idea of what is happening in Portland and why. The police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis may have triggered the rebellion in Portland, but the liberal, progressive city of Portland has had its own share of police brutality problems. For years, hip left-of-center Portland has chafed under an ill-controlled authoritarian police force. And, understandably enough, the Portland protests are focusing on the local police. It's often the poets and artists who first articulate a social problem, and longtime Portland resident, singer-songwriter David Rovix, caught Portland's police problem years ago. Here's a song he recorded back in 2012.
Portland is a town that's in the news much of the time. There are a lot of vegans and there's very little crime. It's a nice, safe place to live. Folks ride bicycles a lot. The winters aren't so cold and the summers aren't so hot. They build houses out of cob. They hang out in the park, where you needn't worry about walking after dark. There are lots of homeless people, but they don't hurt no one. Just be careful of the boys in blue playing with their guns. Yeah, watch out for the cops. 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 You can hang out the punks with the piercings and tattoos. You can eat out at a food truck, any neighborhood you choose. You can dance to Balkan music while you drink a microbrew, chilling in a gay bar with the mayor and his crew. But be careful what you do, be prepared to get some flack, especially for those who may be male, young, and black. The fact is you do better in Sweet Home Alabama. You're safer there on the old streets of Birmingham. Yeah, watch out for the cops. 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 There are flowers everywhere, but for others they've got prisons with some nice electric chairs. You can go downtown, ride the buses there for free, but you never know when you'll get a DWP. A town full of progressives, but such a rotten bunch of cops. Who knows who'll get shot at the next routine traffic stop? When you live in a place like Portland, where they tend to act this way, you can just join the police force instead of the KKK. Yeah, watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops.
Massive citizen protests are not sufficient to compel power to make changes, but massive citizen protests are necessary. As Frederick Douglass correctly noted, power concedes nothing willingly. Power responds only to countervailing power. This was certainly the case with the Vietnam War in the early 1970s. And with more on that subject, let us begin to bring in historian Howard Zinn. So here's a wonderful historical parallel. Widespread local demonstrations against the Vietnam War have been going on for years. Now a huge national demonstration was being planned in Washington, D.C. for the spring of 1971. Over the opposition of the national government, of course. This huge demonstration, it was expected, would seriously disrupt ordinary life in the nation's capital. Now get this, on a Boston public TV station, a local public affairs show named The Advocates featured a debate on such massive public demonstrations versus working through established channels. Representing the establishment position was Harvard Law School professor Roger Fisher. Representing the pro-demonstration position, even if some laws got broken in the process, was famed radical defense attorney William Kunstler. Kunstler would call as his star witness a young history professor at Boston University named Howard Zinn. Fisher's witnesses, previously recorded, included Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill and Liberal Congressman Allard Lowenstein. Moderating the whole show was a rising Massachusetts politician, temporarily out of office, named Michael Dukakis. 4 years later, he would be governor and, in 1988, a presidential candidate. Holy mackerel! What a lineup of intellectual and political talent. Yes, Virginia, there was a time when public broadcasting was not just a mass of corporate-friendly pablum designed to entertain the white middle class. That was back before you were born. there's a strong historical parallel to our present day, which is why I'm bringing in 1971. So let us join Zinn, Kunstler, Dukakis, and Fischer back in 1971 as Zinn explains why mass demonstrations are not only useful, but in fact absolutely necessary in what is supposed to be a democracy. The first voice here belongs to Roger Fischer. The second to Michael Dukakis.
With the seriousness, but it's going to take political effort, effective political effort, within the law.
Thank you, Mr. Fischer. And now we turn to Mr. Kunstler for his rebuttal argument in support of massive civil disobedience.
Well, I wish Tip O'Neill had been here so we could cross-examine him on that statement. But since he is not, I would like to, before calling my rebuttal witness, indicate that we are going to try to prove through this witness that civil disobedience is not what the others have said, but is a viable political tactic and a non-violent tactic. And to do that, I would like to call Howard Zinn to the stand.
Welcome to the Advocates, Professor Zinn.
Howard Zinn is an historian, an old friend of mine, I believe a client somewhere along the way, and he's been involved in civil disobedience both in the South and against the war in Vietnam. Professor Zinn, why civil disobedience today? Why not wait for what our adversary witnesses have said, the normal processes of government, to catch up with the war in Vietnam?
Why do you call him Al and me Professor Zinn?
You're a client.
Now, I was listening to the congressman, the former congressman, the present congressman, the senator, listening to Congressman O'Neill, and they all talk as if the political process were a quite simple one, and that is that if everybody would just be nice and talk nice to your congressman, write him letters, write letters to the newspaper, sign petitions, that the war in Vietnam would end, the bombers would be brought home, the GIs would be brought home, and the power-hungry American military establishment would lose its hunger. That's not the way things have happened in this war, and that's not the way things have happened in history. Throughout American history, the political leaders have always exhorted the American people to be nice and quiet and leave things to them. But when very serious evils confronted the American people, they had to go beyond the congressmen and the senators, and they had to commit civil disobedience, and they had even to break the law. And the abolitionists had to do it. And right here in Boston, they had to violate federal law by trying to bring a slave away from the federal marshals. They had to commit civil disobedience. The labor movement had to do this. They had to violate the law. They had to disrupt things. They had to do all sorts of impolite things. They had the sit-ins of sit-down strikes of 1936 and 37. And only this finally brought that modicum of justice that the labor movement demanded. And the civil rights movement went through the same thing. And you know, the Congress did not act on the civil rights laws of 64 and 65 until blacks went out into the streets and made a commotion. They did not do it on the basis of some polite discourse.
Professor Zinn, if I can interrupt you for a minute, because I want to get, before we run out of time, I want to get to one point. Both Al Lowenstein and Senator Hart and Tip O'Neill have made promises to us tonight. They've said if we wait and don't disrupt Congress and don't get people excited and irritated, then they will end the war in Vietnam by December, according to Mr. O'Neill, by some other date. Why not wait and make them live up to the promissory note they've made?
We have had promissory notes from Congress for 6 years. For 6 years, Congress has promised to preserve our lives, our liberties, and have promised to defend the Constitution of the United States, which is an oath that they took. For 6 years, Congress violated that oath, as the President violated that oath, by carrying on and acceding to a constitutional war. Mr. O'Neill, who exhorts us to quietude and obeisance to law, voted for every single military appropriation bill. Of 21 military appropriation bills brought up before Congress between 1965 and 1970, he voted for every single one of them. No, I don't think we can depend on Congress. And the American political system, you know, we have been brought up to believe that the American political system works beautifully. It is democratic. Congress represents us. The president is elected. He represents us. It doesn't work that way. Democracy depends on people speaking out, and in times of great crisis, on people creating a commotion. Garrison once said, when they accused him of breaking the law, of disrupting things, of antagonizing people, he said, "Slavery, sir, will not be overthrown without excitement."
All right, Mr.
A
Fisher.
Tremendous excitement.
Mr. Thank you, Mr. Zinn.
Good time to have you.
When Garrison made that statement, as quoted by you in your book, he said, "We do not have public opinion on our side, so we must act." Today, on the issue in Vietnam, we have public opinion. Just who is this organized disruptive tactic designed to influence?
The organized disruptive tactic that you keep describing as disruptive...
That's what we're talking
about. Yes, of
course.
...is designed to make people think.
Who?
You know, it's designed to make the public think. It's designed to represent to the public the seriousness of the war. Now, if bombs were falling on Boston tonight, if they were falling on Cambridge, if they were falling all around us, and if children were dying all around us, and this was being decided by people, and these planes were being sent out by people sitting in City Hall, and somebody said, "Let's get everybody together and march on City Hall and stop this," and what would you say? Well, how is this actually going to work? Will the members of the city council be perhaps offended by this? What I'm getting at is that there's something in your comprehension of what is going on in Vietnam which is lacking, and that what is lacking is some understanding of how serious this all is.
Exactly, Mr. Zinn, believe me, my belief in the seriousness is why I think the dropping bombs on Cambridge, like dropping bombs on Hanoi, is not a way of producing effective political action.
But we're dropping bombs every day in Vietnam.
I know, and you seem to think that the same strategy at home is the one to pursue. I'm disagreeing with that.
The same strategy?
Yes.
I'm not suggesting dropping bombs.
The United States is wreaking havoc in Hanoi, and you favor wreaking havoc in Washington.
Are you equating?
Fisher, in fairness to Professor Zinn, I don't think he's talking about dropping bombs,
no.
But he is talking about
disrupting. You believe that physical disruption is going to produce a sensible political result where physical disruption elsewhere does not. We're disagreeing on the consequences of that and also on the costs. Tell me, what should those who are watching this program, perhaps they're in the American Legion members, perhaps who want the president to fight on to military victory, what, according to your philosophy, should they do in May? Go down to Washington?
I can't tell the people who want a military victory.
You are saying act according to your conscience.
Will you let me answer the question? I can't tell the people who want military victory, which is now a minority of the American people, what to do. But that great majority of the American people who are now opposed to the war should do everything that they are impelled by their conscience to do. And you need to recognize that some people are impelled by their conscience to write to their congressman, and other people are compelled by their conscience to go to Washington and to say to the people in the government offices, "Stop work, disobey," because the violence of our time is caused by obedience. No, let me just finish my point. What we are trying to do in Washington is not to tell everybody in the country to do exactly what we're doing. What we're trying to do in Washington is to tell people in the country that they need, in their own way, to disobey the government in every... GIs to disobey the call to war, people to disobey the draft induction
notice.
That's what we need.
We've had examples of that. George Wallace, Governor Faubus, others disobeying the law.
They would do that in any case. They would do that in any case. They aren't stimulated by us.
It's
not our action that brings their action.
Do you believe that might will be right? Are you confident?
This is not might. We're talking about nonviolent action. Are you equating what we are doing in Washington with what is happening every day in Vietnam?
I am acquainting.
This is right against might.
No. The if you right is to act within the law, if you
will
no, operate...
No, right is not only to act within the law. Right
also
is to act according to conscience.
Right. An individual act of conscience to break an unjust law, as in many of the cases you're talking about, I will refuse to obey a law to return a fugitive slave because this would be slavery. That individual act, the individual strikes of the students over Cambodia, which was I will not go to class, that is different than organized action. A group of us are going to get together and physically stop the government. The slogan of the May demonstration is, if the government doesn't stop the war, we will stop the government. We will take the law into our hands, and whoever the consequences, we will impose those. That is the prescription which others have followed. In the Weimar Republic, Hitler followed that.
A short response from Professor Zinn, and then we're going to have to close it. A very short response. Yeah,
this is not the Weimar Republic. This is the United States in 1971.
It's a good time to end it, Professor Zinn, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to. Thank you very, very much for your testimony. Thank you.
Howard Zinn and a handful of others on the necessity of nonviolent resistance and maybe even civil disobedience to unjust laws. That was then. This is now. And hey, what do you know? There are some pretty strong parallels between then and now, between the popular uprising to end the Vietnam War and today's popular uprising to end police racist brutality. I confess, I cannot keep straight all the unjust police shootings of black people in the past decade, not even in the past year. So let's go out with a bit of another song by David Rovics, this one a very recent song, a song designed to jog our memories. First, though, let me thank you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, try to live each day as though the truth were true, in solidarity there is strength, and please tune in again next week. Till then.
Jacob Blake was walking to his SUV. Alton Sterling was selling DVDs. Eric Garner had just broken up a fight. Breonna Taylor was asleep in the middle of the night. Tamir Rice was playing in the park. Elijah McClain was out walking after dark. Dominique Clayton was sleeping in her bed, where she was shot by a cop in the back of her head. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names. Walter Scott was driving to a store. Betty Jones was answering her door. Philando Castile was driving home with his girlfriend. Anthony Hill was naked on the grass when he met his end. Edsel Ford was walking in his neighborhood. Michael Brown was blown away just standing where he stood. Kendra James was shot to death at a traffic stop by yet another unaccountable killer cop. Say their names. Say their names. Say their names.